Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese, and I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Thomas Kelly. Thomas is professor of philosophy at Princeton University. He specializes in epistemology, and as I suspect listeners will know, Thomas has written several influential essays on the epistemology of disagreement. Now, his new book has just been published with Oxford University Press. It's titled Bias, A Philosophical Study. Now, the concept of bias is familiar enough, partly because it's deployed frequently in many different contexts. For example, we talk about biased jurors, biased procedures, biased laws, biased decisions, as well as biased people. But we also talk about bias as a feature of certain frames of mind or habits, dispositions, or mental processes. Now, in a lot of these contexts, maybe most of them, bias is seen as a kind of failing or a bad-making feature of whatever it's ascribed to. Now, attributions of bias, hence, are often accusatory, or at least a matter of negative assessment. Now, although these phenomena are familiar, lots of questions remain. Consider, is bias a single thing? Is it always bad? Is bias always a kind of misleading? Can bias be eliminated? And so on. Now, in his book, Bias, A Philosophical Study, Thomas Kelly addresses a broad range of these questions, maybe most of them, maybe all of them. He develops a norm-theoretic account of what bias is, and then explores its implications, some of which are philosophically pretty surprising. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about, but we normally begin with our guest, and we'll do the same here. Hi, Thomas. How are you?
Really good. Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing fine. As I just said, we begin the program with the author saying a few things about himself. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a native Midwesterner. In fact, I spent the first 22 years of my life in the Midwest, born and grew up in the Chicago area. And then I went to a college in Indiana at the University of Notre Dame. And that was very important to me then as now. Notre Dame had an excellent philosophy department. And that was really where my love of philosophy first ignited at Notre Dame back way back in the last millennium, the 1990s. And like a lot of things that turned out pretty well in my career, it was just dumb luck on my part. I didn't go there because I had a good philosophy department. I had no idea about this. In fact, as I remember, the fact that they had a good football team loomed. They're a really good football team. They won the national championship a couple years before I got there. That loomed much larger for me than they had a good philosophy department. But as a matter of fact, I got really turned on to the subject there and worked with some excellent people. And they really supported me and helped me really progress. And I made it to graduate school at Harvard. And there, too, I kind of benefited from having tremendously supportive teachers. In fact, even though this is decades later, I dedicate this book that we're about to talk about to the people who taught me philosophy, both at Notre Dame, my undergraduate institution, and Harvard, where I was fortunate. So again, it was dumb luck. I went to Harvard thinking I was going to do ethics and then got there, changed my mind. That's why I chose Harvard and ended up doing epistemology. But I ended up with this really excellent committee of the late Robert Nozick, the late Derek Parfit, and Jim Pryor, who's fortunately still with us. And each of those Three People was really wonderful to me in all sorts of ways. And in fact, there is another connection to this book there, which is when I finished my dissertation, finally, my committee, Nozick, Parfit, and Breuer, they said, look, we really liked this. And in fact, we think you should publish it as a book, as opposed to, you know, because they thought that, you know, the whole was greater than the sum of the parts. So rather than do the usual thing of chopping it up into journal articles, why don't you publish it as a book? And I wasn't used to not listening to them or going against their advice. But I decided not to do this because I thought, look, there's this factor they're kind of overlooking, which is people like Nozick and Parfit, they don't really have to worry. If they write a book, a philosophy book, people, at least in philosophy, are going to read it. And I do have this worry. I was a completely unknown graduate student and hadn't published anything so far. And I'm like, who in the world would read this book by me? And I still think that's probably, so I did do the traditional thing, at least among analytic philosophers, chop the thing up into journal articles and so on. But it was a little bit kind of strange to go against their advice. And I was kind of hesitant and so on. And I kind of consoled myself by thinking, look, someday I really will do this thing of write a book. That's why I had this thought. And then another, continue with that kind of train of thought. I started teaching at Princeton University. And I've been teaching here for the last 19 years. And this thing kept happening, at least happened twice, which is, and I assume this is completely standard, you want to come up for promotions, whether it's being promoted from assistant professor to, you know, professor with associate professor with tenure, and then to full professor. One thing, you know, you always submit are these statements about your future research projects and what you'll do if they give you tenure. And every time I come up for promotion at Princeton, I promised and described in great detail a certain book I was planning to write. And it wasn't like, and so anyway, to cut to the chase, none of those books ever got written. And Princeton, perhaps foolishly on their part, kept promoting me anyway. So I don't know what that says about the institution or about me. But in any case, it wasn't like I was...
Or about whether anybody reads those statements.
And it's not like I was ever lying or intentionally misleading anybody. I really did intend to write these books, but for one reason or another, I never did it. And so a few years ago, I was sitting in my office, and I had this thought, look, my whole career, going back to graduate school, either people have been telling me you should write a book, or I've been sincerely but falsely promising my employer and my closest colleagues I'm going to write this book. And here's a crazy idea. Maybe I should write a book. And so I finally actually succeeded in following through and doing the thing. And that's why I get to be here on with you today.
Well, that's fantastic. Can I just add a real just quick question about that sort of origin story of the book, which is very compelling. Was the dissertation connected to the topics of the book that you've just published, or was it orthogonal?
Not at all. So all of these, the dissertation was different. I mean, it was in epistemology in some broad sense, and these books I promised along the way were quite different. So those books, the books I promised to write, will never get written. I think the time for them has passed, and maybe I shouldn't be admitting to this on the air, but I think it's probably too late for Princeton to claw back the promotions that were granted partially on its basis on these promises and so on.
Can I ask one other question along these same lines before we get to talk about the book? If somebody were to ask you, well, I guess I am asking you, like, so you could have written a bunch of books. You have a pretty wide, in your career, you've written about a number of topics, not all of which are connected to bias, although some of them are. When you were in your office thinking, maybe I should write a book, did bias just come out of nowhere as a possible topic, or was it something that you had been thinking about or had an interest in, independent of some of your some of the philosophical work and in more straightforward epistemology topics?
Excellent question. So I've long been interested in the topic, and you mentioned some of my work in disagreement, and that would come up in some context there, because of course one reason why you might discount the views of somebody else is if you think they're biased. And then, of course, you can ask whether that's a reasonable opinion on your part or not. But when I wrote about disagreement, for better or for worse, the literature really went this way, is I really was interested in this question about epistemic peers, which is kind of this technical term, because I thought, yeah, that's really what When disagreement seems kind of pressing to me is when I'm thinking of the person I'm disagreeing with as either somebody who's, my superior in some sense, or at least a peer. And if it's somebody I don't think of as, I think, as, okay, this person just doesn't know about as much about this particular subject matter as I do, then the fact they hold a conflicting opinion doesn't matter so much. So then there's this question of kind of, okay, what types of disagreements do we find intellectually threatening? Well, these peer disagreements seem kind of intellectually threatening, at least prima facie. And who do I consider my peers? Well, people, if I think the person's more biased than I am, then whether rightly or wrongly I think this, or reasonably or unreasonably, that would be a reason to kind of give their opinion less weight and think in rising my own views, perhaps in response to what they think. So I always had this note I always would mention, well, you don't think of your epistemic peers as biased people, or at least people who are more biased than you are, or something like that. But that was kind of unsatisfying. So I always kind of set this aside right away at the beginning of this, talking about this disagreement topic. And I always kind of had in the back of my mind, well, at some point you should really circle back and talk about this notion of bias, which seems so important in these contexts of interpersonal disagreement and many other contexts as well, certainly.
Well, fantastic. So let's talk about the book. It seems it's good to start at the beginning typically, and I think we'll do that this time. The book opens with a discussion of what you call sort of conceptual fundamentals about bias. And part of, one of the things that emerges there is a very general understanding of bias before we get into the analysis. But one of the important implications of that very general sort of treatment of bias is that bias is diverse. Can you tell us a little bit about that diversity?
Absolutely, yeah. So, and this relates to something you actually already mentioned when you said a few opening remarks about bias and the book, is the starting point of the book really is just this observation. And I take it there's a lot of controversial stuff in the book. I think this is relatively uncontroversial, is if you pay attention to the way we talk about bias in ordinary contexts in everyday life. And I don't mean by we, philosophers or even academics, but just ordinary people. It's really quite striking the diverse range of things that get described or evaluated as either biased or unbiased, right? And maybe the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people are in fact people, particular individuals. We say he's biased, she's biased about this issue. And especially in a special context is when we're thinking about people in certain social roles. So the biased judge or the biased reporter, the biased news reporter, and so on. So people, groups of people. So just like we can talk about, maybe you think Clarence Thomas or Sonia Sotomayor has a certain bias or is going to be biased about this issue. Similarly, we can talk about the group of people that is the Supreme Court and whether the Supreme Court has a certain bias. And then there's certain kinds of interesting questions that I got very interested in about how does bias at the level of the group depend on and relate to bias at the level of the individual? And can you have, biased groups that have with all unbiased individuals and so on? These types of questions. So we've got people, groups of people, but then, as you said, lots of other things, right? So particularly interesting and important category for both philosophers and psychologists, I think, are mental states, right? So we talk about biased perceptions and biased beliefs and biased opinions and biased judgments. And as you mentioned, I primarily work in epistemology, and I write about epistemology and topics at the intersection of epistemology and ethics and certain other areas of philosophy. And one thing I've written quite a bit about besides, and along with disagreement, is evidence and certain foundational questions about evidence. And if you go to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, there's an entry by me on evidence, which I need to update one of these days. It's a little outdated, but hopefully there's something valuable there for now. And one thing I noticed is anything that can possibly play the role of evidence is also something that gets described as biased, right? So we talk about biased testimony or biased data, biased information, biased studies, biased research, biased samples, and on and on. So it was already connected to things I was interested in, and connected to that last group of things. Generally, sources of information are putative information, as in Fox News has a conservative bias, or MSNBC has a progressive bias, or whatever. Right? And it could go on and on, but you get the point. There's an awful lot of things that we describe as bias and unbiased just in the course of everyday discourse. And it's possible to overstate things. Not everything is the kind of thing that can be biased or unbiased. So if I said to you, Bob, you know, you've never been in my office, but my office desk chair, my desk is biased. That doesn't seem to make any sense. You wouldn't know what I was saying. So it doesn't seem like desks can be the kind of things that are biased or unbiased. And that's true of many other things as well. But on the other hand, many things are very much the kinds of things that can be biased and unbiased. And moreover, it's not just that very different things, but even when we think in terms of kind of fundamental philosophical ontological categories, right? So on the one hand, we have no problem at all with kind of temporally extended processes, whether describing them as biased, whether it's cognitive processes or some kind of social process or the biased admissions process or a biased job search or something like this. But on the other hand, we're perfectly happy to attribute bias to lots of things that aren't temporally extended processes, even inanimate objects in some cases, biased dice and biased coins and so on. And similarly, lots of these distinctions, which venerable philosophical distinctions, which go way back in philosophy, universal, particular, abstract, concrete, we're perfectly happy to, without any hesitation at all, to attribute bias to things on both sides of the line, right? So we can talk about a particular episode of reasoning, like some token psychological process that some particular individual engages in that begins at a certain moment in time and ends at another moment in time. Think about that particular process of this concrete process of reasoning as biased. On the other hand, people also talk about universals or abstract types of reasoning, right? And just say, that way of reasoning is a biased type of reasoning, where it's not something that happens at a particular place in time, because that type can be instantiated by many different people at many different places and times. So that's really the starting point of the book, is just how liberal we are, at least in our ordinary thought and talk about bias. And what should we make of that? What kind of order can we impose? Conceptual order can we impose upon it?
Good. And I take it that the answer that emerges to the question you just formulated, what kind of order can we impose, is maybe not all that much, right? So you wind up defending what you call a robust pluralism about bias. So I take it that. That entails that any hope that one might have of sort of unifying all of these different sites and foci of bias under some more general theory, or reducing them all to some more simple conception, that ambition is doomed to fail. Can you tell us a little bit about the pluralist element?
Good. So the robust pluralism that you mentioned, so there's two aspects to it. There's the pluralism and the robustness. And the pluralism really is just, the starting point is this uncontroversial thing that, look, we at least talk this way. And then, of course, as always in philosophy, there's this question, how seriously should we take, and to what extent is the way we ordinarily talk, does that map onto reality? And you could imagine somebody saying that, look, the fact that we attribute bias all over the place is kind of, that's kind of a loose speech or sloppy thought on our part, or maybe it's metaphorical. Certain things are really biased, and when we apply it to other things, that's kind of metaphorical, not literally true. But the pluralism is, no, we really are picking up on something, and there's a real diverse collection of things that really do have the property bias, whatever that is. And so that's pluralism. Then there's this issue that you raise, and this is where the kind of robustness comes in, about, look, even if you think lots of different things are biased, it could be that some of these are fundamental in some very strong sense. And I want to not push back on your question, but I do think that there are important dependency relations and relations of priority out there. So let me try to make this bit more concrete. So suppose we're thinking about a particular judge who reaches a decision by deliberating in a particular court case. And let's just suppose we say, look, the guy's a biased judge. So on this particular case, the guy is a biased judge. And this particular occasion, he reasons in a biased way and arrives at a biased verdict. So maybe it's a criminal case, and there's a biased verdict that the defendant is guilty. Right? So here we've got three different things to which we're attributing bias. The judge himself, the person, the deliberative process, the biased process of reasoning, and the verdict that comes out the other end, the verdict that the guy's guilty. And then we can ask, look, assuming in the usual case, it's not a coincidence that all three of these things are biased, what are the relationships here, right? So for example, a plausible thought is, look, if it's a biased verdict, that must be because the process that led to it is a biased process or something like that. On the other hand, you might think, well, look, then we can ask, what makes the process biased? Maybe it's characteristic of bias. How we define, get a grip on a notion of a biased process is, those are the processes that tend to lead to certain kinds of verdicts, namely biased verdicts, whether you're kind of making the verdict kind of explanatorily prior. So I do think in lots of cases you find these explanatory relationships, but it's a good question how it goes. So I think philosophers, at least many of us, I'm no exception to this, are kind of suckers for these explanatory priority type questions, going back to Socrates, you know, Plato and Socrates and Euthyphro. Certain actions, are they pious because they're loved by the gods, or rather are they loved by the gods because of their pious? Incidentally, just parenthetically, when I talk to psychologists about stuff in the book, there's lots of questions that I get them very interested in and excited about. This isn't one of them. I'm inclined to think this really is a kind of philosophical, or maybe this is our bias or my bias or something. This really, these kinds of explanatory priority questions, even among theoretically minded psychologists, at least ones I talk to, are maybe less interesting to them. Nevertheless, I'm interested in them. And sorry, so a little digression there, but robustness, you could imagine, and you're absolutely right, I don't go for a strongly reductionist view, which I think would be, I'm still kind of attracted to it in a certain kind of way, because it'd be kind of really quite intellectually satisfying if it were true. But you could imagine somebody thinking, look, even though lots of things are biased, one of these, or one type of thing, maybe it's biased processes or something, is really what's fundamental. And anything else that counts as biased is because it's how it's related to this more fundamental thing. So here's an analogy that I like to use that I think is helpful, at least for me, in terms of the possibilities here, is there's a pretty, I think, still pretty common view among philosophers about truth and the nature of truth that became pretty popular in the 20th century. And that view goes like this. We should be pluralists about truth in the following sense, is lots of different things, and in fact, lots of different types of things belonging to even radically different categories, can be true or false. So for example, certain sentences in a natural language, like the English sentence, snow is white, that has the property of being true. Certain mental states, my belief that snow is white, that mental state can have the property of being true. Certain particular speech acts, so my saying on a particular occasion that snow is white, maybe that speech act has the property of being true. So that's kind of lots of different things can be true or false. But there's one thing that's very special or kind of privileged, namely propositions, right? And this is one reason why the notion of a proposition became so important to 20th century analytic philosophy, the view that really the fundamentally true or false things are propositions, the proposition that snow is white, and anything else that has a property of being true has that because of the way it's related to the true proposition, right? So maybe the English sentence snow is white counts as true because it expresses a certain proposition. Maybe my belief that snow is white is true is because it puts me into believing a relation to a proposition. So that would be a view that's pluralistic in that lots of things count as true, but one of them is fundamental. And the analogous view about bias would be, although lots of things are genuinely biased, one of these is fundamental, and then that's where really that's how bias gets into the world, so to speak, in virtue of being related to this kind of thing. Anything else that's not that kind of thing is biased, that's biased, is because of its relation, right? And I argue, this is an issue where I've kind of gone back and forth, and I end up coming out against that view. And so this is the robust pluralism, is nothing is fundamental in every context. In different contexts, although there are these dependence relations of explanatory dependence, as we'd expect, it's not a coincidence that the judge has the property of being biased and his verdict is biased and the process is biased. In different contexts, different things can be fundamental in the order of explanation. So I think often it is the process. So I think that at least in the usual case, if it's a verdict like, guilty, I think in order to know whether it's a biased verdict, you really do need to know about whether the process that gave rise to it or produced it is a biased process. So there, I think, in that kind of case, it's often the process which is fundamental, at least compared to the output of the process. Maybe then you want to say maybe there's even something more fundamental than the process. But in other cases, I think that even something that's an output of a process, we're prepared to count it as biased. And I think correctly so in some cases, well, that's not a matter so much of the process that led to it, right? So contrast the judge's verdict that the person's guilty. There, I think you really do need to know something about the process in order to know whether it's biased or not. But suppose this is a belief the judge has. A judge has a belief with the following content. Black defendants who appear in my courtroom are more likely to be to genuinely committed the crimes of which they're accused than the white defendants who appear in my courtroom. And let's assume that this is a false belief on the judge's part. I think at that point, we are, and I argue this is correct and defensible, we're prepared to count that belief as a biased belief in virtue of its content, even before we know anything about the process that led to it, right? Presumably there is some cognitive process, and you can imagine a very funny story where, it seems like a reasonable process, and the judge's evidence was just very misleading on this point. So the process seems pretty impeccable. Nevertheless, if that's the content of the belief, the black defendants in my courtroom are more likely to be guilty of the crimes of which they're committed than the white defendants, and it's false, we're prepared, in virtue of its content, to count that as a biased belief. Unlike the verdict case, where the bare, it's a different case, it's not the same judge, the bare verdict, the guy's guilty, there it really does depend on the process. So that's the robustness in the pluralism. Lots of different things are genuinely biased, and moreover, no one of them is fundamental in every context. In different contexts, different things can be fundamental in the order of explanation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Perfect. That, and for what it's worth, that sounds to me deeply compelling. but there is a... even robust pluralism has its limits. So there is a core account that you give of what bias is. One of the things that seems steady across all of the variations across the sort of the spectrum of the pluralism is that what we're picking out when we're talking about bias, or at least what we're picking out when we're talking about it correctly, is something captured by what you call the norm theoretic account of what bias is. This is the view that says that bias involves a kind of systematic deviation from a relevant norm or standard of correctness. Can you spell out some of the details of the norm theoretic view of what biases are?
Sure. And so here's an analogy that I found pretty useful in my experience in terms of kind of warming people up to the general way in which I'm thinking about things. So imagine that you and I right now are standing outside in a field, and we're watching three archers, people with bow and arrow, shooting at a target at a distance. And so we've got these three archers, and we're watching how often they hit the target. And we see one of the three archers is very skilled and consistently hits the target, and the other two are unskilled, and they're typically missing. But there's an important difference among the two archers who characteristically miss. One of the two, it's completely unpredictable how they're going to miss, right? So he's as likely to miss high as low, and as likely to miss to the right as to the left, and so on. And on the other hand, the third archer characteristically misses low and to the left. Maybe not every time, but often enough that if we're going to predict what's going to happen, oh, he's very likely to go low and to the left. And it's important. Maybe there's a hitch in the person's shooting form that is kind of responsible for this. And it's important that even when that archer's not shooting, it's still true that he's disposed to miss low and to the left. Mm. And idea, let's try to think of bias, the biased person at first, at least, like the third archer who's disposed to miss the target in a certain direction, as opposed to the first archer who's reliably hitting the target, or the second archer who's missing it but is missing all over the place. And if we try to understand bias in terms of that analogy, then the following question comes up right away. So for the archers, there's kind of this clear standard of success, namely hitting the target. And then we can ask, look, what corresponds to hitting the target? What's analogous to hitting the target when we're talking about bias? And in my preferred framework, that comes to the question, which standard is it? Which norm, if we're talking about people, or which standard is it relative to which somebody might count as biased because they're disposed to depart from that standard in a certain directed, in a certain direction or a certain directed way? And I think the answer to that question, which standard is at issue when we're talking about bias, is it's shifty. It depends. It varies from context to context. And in lots of cases, the relevant standard I think people have in mind when they're talking about bias is truth or accuracy, right? So statisticians will say, look, there's two types of errors. There's a distinction among types of errors. There's random errors and systematic errors. Where intuitively, again, random error is missing all over the map, and systematic error is missing in some direction, some patterned, predictable way. And here, even before we start thinking about people, we can think about, for example, methods for forecasting the weather. So if we've got a weather forecasting method and it keeps, and it's kind of, we're looking to it for predictions of what the daily high temperature is going to be. And we can imagine one weather forecasting method that's like the second archer, where, you know, it's sometimes it misses high, sometimes it misses low, it's kind of unpredictable. Then we're going to say, look, that's an unbiased method, even though it's unreliable, as opposed to a weather forecasting model that's consistently too high in its predictions. Then, because of the way it's inaccurate, we're going to say not only is it unreliable, but it's a biased model, right? And in many contexts in which we're talking about bias, including in many cases where we're talking about human believers, I think that is the relevant standard that we have in mind when we're making attributions of bias is truth or accuracy. But I don't think truth or accuracy is the only standard we have in mind, even when we're talking about people. I think especially when we're talking about people or agents more broadly, often the relevant standard is something, some kind of practical norm. Maybe it's a norm of practical rationality. So if you think, as many economists and social scientists and others do, that the norm that governs rational action is something like maximize expected utility, then we can talk about certain kinds of practical biases or behavioral biases relative to that norm. The person who has a status quo bias, what's true of them? They're disposed to depart from the norm, maximize expected utility, in the direction of the status quo, right? When they miss in a certain direction. The practical norm might be a moral norm, right? So suppose we think it's a genuine moral norm of morality that treat people with the respect to which they're entitled. So somebody who frequently fails to do that, they might not be biased. They might just be an unbiased jerk, right? They, no matter who they're dealing with, they're thinking that, not treating with respect. They're an equal opportunity offender, as it were. But suppose it's more like this. They're more likely to violate this respect norm with respect to blacks as opposed to whites, or women as opposed to men, or the old as opposed to the young, or vice versa for any of those, then their failures, their deviations really do have the right kind of pattern. And it's appropriate to attribute to them a racist, sexist, or ageist bias, as the case may be, right? And one more final example of this, I think in lots of cases, theoretical rationality or epistemic norms. So if you think it's a norm, proportion your beliefs to the evidence, then it might be that, I mentioned I'm a Notre Dame football fan. Suppose, this isn't true actually, but I'm always overly optimistic. Given my evidence, I shouldn't be as confident they're going to win as I am. Then I'm deviating from this norm, proportion your beliefs to the evidence, but it's not random. It's not sometimes I'm too confident, sometimes I'm not confident enough. It has this pattern, so I count as a biased believer, as opposed to merely somebody who's imperfectly rational. Okay. So those are just a few examples how I'm thinking about it. I don't claim any great novelty for this particular way of thinking about it. But one thing that I do in the book is suggest that when that kind of simple and in some ways familiar picture is developed and refined in the most plausible way, it has certain interesting and radical implications. So, for example, I argue that both morality and rationality sometimes can require us to be biased, including in a pejorative sense of bias. Right. And I also suggest that thinking about bias in this way is fruitful. So this is a theory of bias, the phenomenon in the world itself, as opposed to a theory of our practice of attributing it. But I do think when you think about bias in this way, it's fruitful in that it has certain kind of applications for our practices and helps us understand better our practices of attributing bias, both to other people and to ourselves.
Right. So I want to pick up on the bias attribution stuff in a second. But before we move on, I came to the book, I guess, having the range of ordinary thoughts that people, maybe particularly philosophers, might have about bias. And so the norm theoretic account struck me as just the natural account that bias has to be some kind of disposition to or systematic deviation from a relevant norm. Just quickly, in the psychological or the more empirical literature on bias, are there competing accounts of bias that don't have sort of norms at their center? I'm just curious, actually.
Yeah, good. So I mean this to be, I mean, I would actually regard it as an objection to what I'm doing if psychologists thought, no, you're talking about something else, right?
Right.
So I think there are certain differences between my theory and particular individuals, but I think at a high level of abstraction, it is meant to capture what psychologists have in mind. In particular, in the Kahneman-Tversky paradigm, for example, where they really are thinking, here are the relevant norms, decision theoretic norms and so on, and making judgments of bias relative to those. Certainly objections get raised to this way of thinking about bias. I've got an earful about them already, and I'm sure more will be coming. It is meant to capture a lot of our talk about bias, not just in ordinary life, but also the way it's being used in, say, psychology and so on.
Okay, that's good. So on your view, then, one of the further feature of the view is that our attributions of bias are in some basic sense perspectival. Could you explain that?
Yeah, good. Thanks. So yeah, this is a key idea in the book. And so let's talk about politics.
Right.
We never have really met, but I assume you've got, as we all do, lots of opinions about politics, about which policies are good policies and which politicians are at least relatively good leaders and which ones are likely to lead us off the cliff if they got enough power and so on. And don't worry, I'm not going to put you on the spot. We don't want to alienate any listeners or I don't want to get some kind of fight over the air. I don't know your political views. But I assume you've got these views about politics. And I'm also willing to guess that you've got at least some opinions about who's biased about politics. For example, right. Maybe you think that Fox News has a conservative bias or MSNBC has a progressive bias or New York Times has certain biases in the way they cover certain issues. And it might be that you've got these opinions as well about particular individuals. So, for example, maybe you think, again, as many of us do, that certain members of your extended family have certain political biases or biased about politics in certain ways. And then you've got to kind of negotiate these things and kind of steer clear in a certain kind of way at Thanksgiving dinner or whatever, right? So on the one hand, you know, you've got opinions about politics. And on the other hand, you've got these opinions about who's biased about politics and in what ways, or and who's at least relatively unbiased about politics. And maybe nobody's perfectly unbiased about politics, but some people, maybe more than others, are unbiased, manage to be unbiased. And the perspectival character of bias attributions is just, first approximation is just, look, these two kinds of opinions, opinions about politics and opinions about who's biased about politics, are not independent of one another, either psychologically or rationally. So start with the psychology. So as a psychological matter, your political opinions will tend to influence your judgments about who's biased about politics and who isn't in predictable ways, right? So you've got very conservative kind of first order political opinions that will tend to make a difference to your judgments about who's biased about politics and in what ways than if you had very liberal political opinions. So that's kind of moving from your views about politics to your views about who's biased about politics. But of course, there's psychological influence in the other direction as well. So, you know, the guy who thinks that Fox News is an unbiased source of political information and so relies on it for views about information about politics or putative information about politics, that person is going to end up with, we'd expect, with quite different views about politics than the person who thinks Fox News is a severely biased source of political information and so doesn't listen to it and ignores it, right? So at the level of psychology, there's a kind of reciprocal influence between, you know, for example, your political views and your views about political bias. And of course, ultimately, that's psychology. It's the job of a psychologist to tell us exactly how that's working. I do make certain claims, but I think they're kind of very plausible and kind of well-grounded in experience and not contradicted by empirical findings or anything like that. But in any case, another aspect to this perspectival character of bias attributions that's ultimately more important for me is its rational aspect. So I think that there's a kind of parallelism between what's true at the psychological level and what's true at the rational level. And so I think there's certain kind of rational connections. Which political views you hold will rationally constrain and rationally influence which views you end up holding about who's biased about politics and who's not. And again, the influence is a reciprocal one. Your kind of higher order judgments, your judgments about who's biased, will also exert rational influence on your first order judgments about the subject matter itself, in this case, politics. Right? So in the same way, I think that the phenomenon of bias, the thing in the world, has a certain kind of structure. I also think that our judgments about bias have a certain kind of structure or internal logic that rationally connects them to our judgments about the world itself. And I argue that that fact has certain kinds of interesting implications. For example, when it comes to disagreement with, when you disagree with other people or other political parties or whatever. And so, you know, this picture, both psychologically and rationally, disagreements about first order questions, for example, about the merits of alternative political policies, those kind of naturally bleed into disagreements about who's biased and who isn't. And in certain kinds of cis pattern disagreements, we're more or less forced, that is kind of not just psychologically, but kind of, that might be true or not, but kind of rationally forced to see those, see people on the other side as biased in their views. And in fact, I think in many cases of persistent disagreement, we're rationally committed to viewing folks on the other side as not only mistaken, which is kind of trivial, right? If I think, yeah, such and such is a good policy and you think it's a bad policy, of course, I'm kind of rationally committed to thinking you're wrong, at least insofar as I go on holding my view in the face of your disagreement. But I think beyond that, in certain kinds of cases of more systematic disagreement, we're rationally committed to thinking people on the other side are not only mistaken, but they're also biased. And I think that happens even in cases where you don't really know any details about the other person's psychology. And this is a conclusion a lot of people kind of push back on when they give talks and so on, is I think, well, really, to know whether the person's biased, you've got to know what's going on inside their head. Whereas I think that to the extent you're sticking to your guns on certain issues and certain kinds of disagreements, there's a kind of rational compulsion to attribute bias to the other person, Just from the nature of the disagreement itself, even if you're not clear about, you know, why they first came to hold these views or why they currently held those views. But I should say, I've been using the example of politics because I think that's kind of a vivid one and we picture certain kinds of biases and so on. But the idea that what I'm calling the perspectival character of bias attributions, which of course gets spelled out in greater detail in the book than I'm able to do here, but it has nothing to do with politics in particular. It's supposed to be completely general. So to the extent it's right, well, I'm right when I'm talking about this, it holds for the weather just as much as it holds for politics, right? So your beliefs about the weather influence both psychologically and rationally your beliefs about which weather forecasters and weather forecasting methods are biased and unbiased, and vice versa. If you've got beliefs about which weather forecasting methods are biased, those will make a difference to what it's rational for you to think about the weather itself.
Right. And can I, just a quick question on that. So, and I guess this is the most natural thought in the politics example or the example of persistent disagreement of a complicated sort that involves, you know, a mixture of empirical and valuational claims and all the rest. But I take it that it maybe generalizes, namely that attributions of bias is sort of seem compelling to us because they're a kind of handy inference to the best explanation of the persistence of the disagreement or the systematicity of the error. Does that seem right?
That does seem right. And that's a really good point, really good way of putting it. It's not that there is a difference. So I said, so set aside bias for a moment. Whenever you disagree with somebody, there's a certain kind of rational commitment as long as you retain your belief. And let's make it, you know, there's these funny cases of kind of pathological belief where I believe this is true, but I don't reflectively endorse it. I think I'm being irrational at the very moment I'm holding the belief. Let's not make it a case like that. I believe P, you believe not P. You know, in some sense, difficult to spell out perhaps, but as long as I believe that P, I'm kind of committed to thinking you're wrong about, you know, in believing not P, right? Now, of course, it could be the right thing to do is once I learn that you think not P, I should give up my belief that P. But and then you can do the epistemology of disagreement, what factors make a difference, and so on. I've got endless patience for those kinds of questions and so on, but I'll move on from them now. So there's that. In that kind of case, that's like a matter of logic alone that if P is true, not P is false, right? So it's a kind of, yeah. I don't think in the bias case, it's ever a matter of logic alone that, well, I think this set of things is true, and you think, so suppose that when we talk about politics, again, I have no idea about your political views, suppose that it's pretty consistent that, you know, maybe we usually agree about politics, but whenever we do disagree, you're to my right, right? Mm-hmm. Alternatively, to my left. At a certain point, to the extent I retain my beliefs, I'm going to start to think, and again, it's very natural to do it in terms of a kind of inference best explanation model, that, Bob's biased, and I'm going to predict the next time we disagree, you're going to miss to my right rather than to my left or, you know, something else. But I think there is this difference. I don't think, in part because, you know, inference best explanation, I don't think it's a matter of logic. In the same way that, you know, I could, we flip a coin, and maybe it's an open question whether it's a biased coin or an unbiased coin. I keep seeing it comes up heads time after time, or, you know, some big number of trials. There's many more heads than tails and so on. I don't think I'm ever inconsistent. I could think, no, it really is a fair coin. It's an unbiased coin. It's on a long run of heads, and probably it'll turn around and end up 50-50 in the even longer run. I don't think it's ever logically inconsistent to do that. Nevertheless, at a certain point in time, I think it'd be irrational to start believing or to keep believing it's a fair coin that just happens to keep, you know, it's 50-50 chance, keeps happening to go one way rather than the other way. I think that's how it is in some of these systematic disagreement cases. In principle, if you keep missing to my right in politics or keep missing to my left, I might think, look, it's not the case that the next time we disagree, he's any more likely to miss to my right. It's just he's making a bunch of random mistakes, right? Right. But at a certain point of time, I think that's not the right thing to conclude. I think, no, you'll attribute bias. And I do find it, although I don't emphasize this in the book, I think it's perceptive from your part, I do find an inference best explanation model here, a very natural one that to apply in this kind of case.
Well, great. So what we're just talking about, the sort of the perspectival nature of these attributions, has an important implication, you argue, for the bias blind spot, the our uncanny ability to see bias in others and not the same biases in ourselves. Can you tell us a little bit about the blind spot and what the implications for it are for given the perspectival nature of the attributions?
Yeah, great. So as you said, the bias blind spot, this is this well-documented and widespread tendency for people to believe, and I include myself in this, that we're more objective and less biased than our peers. I'm not using peers in any very special sense, but just kind of people around us and so on. And so the bias blind spot, the blind spot metaphor is just like cars have blind spots. You can't see this particular area. Similarly, we have this blind spot when it comes to attributions of bias, namely ourselves. And we're relatively quick to judge other people as biased and very slow to judge that we're biased. And you might think, look, that's not so surprising. I didn't need the psychologist to tell me this is true. But in fact, they've done all kinds of fascinating research on this that, some of this seminal work in this area is done by my colleague in the psychology department here at Princeton, Emily Pronin. I got kind of really interested in this. It's probably my favorite bias. In any case, I certainly don't challenge any of the empirical findings of the psychologists. What I do offer in the book is a novel, what I take to be a novel explanation of the bias blind spot, one that to some extent is an alternative explanation to the hypotheses that the psychologists are throwing out and they've suggested here. And basically my line about this is, once we get really clear about the norm-theoretic nature of bias and the perspectival character bias attributions and how bias attributions work in general, how a person's views about the world influence both rationally and psychologically their judgments about bias, you'll see that that's the bias blind spot is exactly what we'd expect to happen. Right. Because of the ways in which your views about the world, your first order views about the world, kind of rationally and psychologically influence and constrain your judgments about who's biased and who isn't, including yourself. And here, it looks like I'm kind of going out on a limb. The social psychologists have their own preferred explanations for this, involving a certain kind of introspection illusion and this view they call a naive realism, which is somewhat different from what we philosophers, philosophers use the term naive realism. And as I say, and I'm open to this, look, it's kind of, it's plausible that there's a lot of different factors going on, kind of multiple mechanisms that contribute to the bias blind spot. So isn't it ultimately an empirical question what exactly is going on with human beings? And I agree with that, except there's an argument in the book to this point that, look, a lot of these mechanisms psychologists are talking about, even if, perhaps counterfactually, none of them were operative, we'd still expect people to, human beings, to in general be prone to this bias blind spot, precisely because of the perspectival character bias attributions that... given that you're kind of making judgments about bias based on systematic departures from the truth, if we're talking about belief and so on, in that case, given that your own access to the truth is mediated by your own beliefs, just applying that basic framework, you get out that there will be an important first person versus third person asymmetry in the conditions under which we're in a position to identify biases in our own case, and the conditions in which we're in a position to identify bias in the case of other people, where it's not primarily a matter of introspection, as the psychologists think. I mean, I think there's an important difference between the kinds of the ways in which introspection can go wrong, something specific about introspection, and the kinds of systematic blind spots that come with making judgments from your own point of view using your own beliefs. And one way of appreciating this difference is, look, there's this asymmetry between when I make judgments about my own biases and other people's biases. I'm inclined to think, across a range of circumstances and so on, I'm less biased than other people. There's this other asymmetry that comes up that seems, you might think, is closely related here. It's also kind of unsurprising, but I think is very significant here, which is when we make judgments about other people, right, so setting ourselves to the side, we're much more inclined to judge people who disagree with us as biased right. than people who agree with us, right? And there, when I'm thinking about other people, a story about introspection doesn't seem to have the same kind of application, because when it comes to other people, I'm no more in a position to introspect how other people, the people who agree with me, arrived at their views, than I'm in a position to introspect how people disagree with me arrived at their views. Nevertheless, I think using the perspectival character bias attributions, you can tell a compelling story about why we end up thinking people agree, we tend to end up thinking people agree with us are less biased and people disagree with us. And then we can kind of turn around and apply that very story to our own case. So the thought is, I'm thinking, look, it's no accident. You don't want two separate explanations of these two well-documented by psychologists. Psychologists can give you lots and lots of evidence. If you had any doubt, if you ever doubt it was true, both that we're inclined to think of ourselves as more objective than other people. And then when it comes to other people, we're inclined to think the people who agree with us, generally speaking, are more objective than people who disagree with us. I'm thinking we don't want two separate explanations of these well-documented facts. It's no that accident right we got me. That combination rather than some other combination. Yeah. The proposal I make in the book is let's maybe think about the bias blind spot as something like a special case of the fact that I tend to see people who agree with me as less biased than people who disagree with me. In fact, it's kind of the limiting case because generally speaking, setting aside certain kind of pathological cases in which I'm alienated from my own current beliefs, my agreement with my current self is probably the most perfect of all, right? So that's kind of a proposal I make there. And again, that tends to push in the direction of not giving so much weight to introspection, given that we're really viewing the first person case as a special case of disinclined to attribute bias, or at least less inclined to attribute bias, all else being equal, to people who agree with me as opposed to people who disagree with me.
Great. So, Tom, we're coming to the end of our conversation, and I've got sort of two questions left on the agenda. Let me just throw them both out there and let you navigate. One is a very specific question about introspection, as we were just talking about, how it's not a good guide to detecting our own biases. So this, it picks up on what we were just discussing. But I also wanted to ask about the third part of the book, in particular, the position that you defend that there's such a thing as biased knowing. So pick up on either of those or both of them or whatever seems best to you.
Well, let me, although I love to talk about biased knowing, let me talk about introspection just because what I just said, it seems like in certain contexts I am downplaying. Maybe introspection isn't quite as important in producing this phenomenon as psychologists thought. But I do have ideas about introspection, including some radical ones in the book that I kind of throw out there. And again, so as you said, it's, introspection is generally agreed isn't a good way of detecting our own biases. And this is an absolute commonplace among the social psychologists. And I don't doubt that they're correct. I think their evidence is compelling and it's intuitively plausible to begin with. But even once we grant that, look, I agree. If you're wondering whether you're biased about something, saying, look, let me introspect for a while and see whether it seems to me whether I'm biased or not. That's not a good way of doing it, right? If you are biased, it's not likely to show up. I think there is this interesting philosophical question here, whether or not the psychologist would be interested in this, is, look, how contingent is that introspection is an unreliable way of detecting bias? And one reason I find this question kind of interesting is it's another question where I completely changed my mind about it over the course of writing the book. When I first started thinking about these issues, I thought, look, this is, this discovery of empirical psychology, and maybe we already knew it empirically, but it's a contingent matter. It's true that introspection turns out not to be reliable, but it could have been reliable, right? After all, introspection is reliable for all kinds of things. When it comes to telling whether you're sad or not, it seems like introspection is a reliable way of doing it. It's not perfect. Maybe there's some subtle cases where I'm sad, but I don't know by introspection. My therapist has to tell me or something. But generally speaking, it's pretty good when it comes to detecting sadness. And I was like, surely it could have been equally good or about as good when it comes to detecting bias, right? Evolution or God or both could have given us a much better tool than in fact we were given here for this purpose, detecting whether we're biased. After all, we can easily imagine that the ordinary five senses could have been much sharper than they are. Then we'd be picking up on all kinds of things that we're missing, certain smells that the dogs can pick up on that we don't pick up on. Introspection could have been like that with respect to bias. When bias is around, it pretty much tells us that it is. I came to doubt this. And so the view I end up defending in the book is that really it's this quite deep fact, and it's no accident that introspection turns out to be unreliable for this purpose. When I try to be provocative, maybe this is overstating things a bit, I say even God couldn't have made us highly reliable detectors of our biases by way of introspection. I think we could have been better than we in fact are, but I don't think, so here's a more concrete comparison. I don't think we could have been as reliable when it comes to detecting bias as we in fact are when it comes to detecting sadness. Mm-hmm. Why is that? I think that generally speaking, so again, think about the belief case where it's characteristic of the biased believer to have formed beliefs that systematically depart from the truth about a certain topic in a certain direction. And generally speaking, well, I mean, we don't have our access to the truth is mediated by our own beliefs. So I think generally speaking, it's no accident that we won't be good at picking up on recognizing from the inside the kinds of systematic departures from the truth that are characteristic of the biased believer. And so the introspection is, there are some really substantial limits here, I think. I don't want to overstate it. I think certain kinds of biases, introspection could have been better at identifying, right? Take wishful thinking. That's a paradigmatic bias. And wishful thinking is, to a first approximation, something like you're missing the truth. You tend to miss the truth in the direction of your desires, right? So it's non-random. It's kind of in direction of your desires, your preferences. And I could imagine that, you know, we're so constituted so that when my desires or preferences start getting involved in my theoretical reasoning in this kind of illicit way, a little bell goes off, right? Or something like this, or a little siren in my head, or some light starts flashing or something. Then I know by introspection, okay. But I think that the thought that introspection could have been generally reliable when it comes to picking up bias depends on a certain way of thinking about bias where all bias is to be understood on the model of wishful thinking. And I think, although wishful thinking is a kind of paradigmatic bias, I think there are lots of other biases, including some paradigmatic ones, that are kind of relevantly different. So certain kinds of biases that depend on the way in which we're embedded in the world, the way we're kind of embedded in our social environments, we don't really have access, the kind of access we need in order for introspection to be reliable at detecting those kinds of biases. And I think that same point, the arguments I give in the book, to the extent they're any good at all, would still hold even if introspection was much sharper than it actually is in practice.
That's very interesting. Can I just a quick follow-up?
Sure.
I take it that your view is that introspection is a skill or a capacity that can be more or less well trained. Am I right about that?
It is. I mean, I'm kind of reluctant to commit myself to, I mean, introspection is so difficult to think about. I'm reluctant to commit myself to some particular model of it, but maybe I am committed by certain things I say, but let's run with it.
All right. So I'm just wondering and again, here I'm just thinking of cases in which, here's a real weird sort of analogy. So, in informal logic, it looks as if the fallacy has this peculiar feature to it. It's like you can commit it only in virtue of your command of the of the conceptual inventory of fallacies.
Good.
Right? Okay. So I'm just wondering if there isn't something similar
here. Fallacy is the fallacy of thinking something's a fallacy when it's actually not.
That's right. Or of calling out perfectly good reasoning, but by using the name of a fallacy and misidentifying it. I'm just wondering if you think that there wouldn't be cases in which the tools that can better inform or better tune our introspection, certain conceptual tools, even the vocabulary of bias, knowing that there are things like wishful thinking and confirmation bias and right side bias and all the rest, right? I'm just wondering if you think there aren't cases in which having a command of that conceptual idiom might foul our attempts to detect our own biases by way of introspection, because having a command of that vocabulary enables us to rationalize in certain ways we wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, excellent suggestion. And it's fascinating the extent to which, I mean, I think the point even generalizes is the ways in which intelligence and learning more about the world can actually make them more biased, right?
Right.
They find that highly educated people, I have to be careful exactly what the facts here are, but highly educated people, when given what looks like pretty clear counter evidence against one of their beliefs, are actually in some ways better at kind of explaining it away, right? So they end up, as opposed to people who don't have a certain kind of conceptual sophistication, perhaps, and so just kind of give up their beliefs, which is maybe, or weaken them at least, which is maybe what they should be doing rather than digging in their heels. But I think in general, certain kinds of conceptual sophistication, gaining certain kinds of conceptual sophistication, gaining more information can increase bias. And I think the thing you're talking about is a very plausible, as a special case of this kind of phenomenon.
Right. There's some reason to think that acquiring certain pieces of political information, and by there I mean information in the success sense, like you're getting, you know, more rational beliefs about political stuff. But it looks as if there are certain reasons to think that gaining political information makes you a more biased voter.
Mm. Right.
Great. Yeah, great. So I wanted to give you the chance, the last minute or two, can you just say one or two quick things about what I thought, at least for the epistemologist who'll be reading the book, I thought was a real provocative discussion, that biased knowledge is possible. Do you have the quick and dirty version of that, that you can just announce?
Good. Quick and dirty is natural thought. So knowledge seems like this cognitively good state. Bias, at least in the pejorative sense, seems like this cognitively bad thing. How are these related? Natural thought, being biased, at least when the bias is sufficiently strong, excludes knowledge, right? So the biased person, the severely biased person, doesn't know, even if they turn out to be right, right? So there's sort of kind of incompatibility. I push back on this and argue that look, even in cases where the bias is so strong that it kind of guarantees the person would believe what they end up believing, no matter what the evidence was like and so on, it might still be knowledge. And I give arguments for this. Then there's a question, well, who cares? Does this have any significance? And I argue, yeah, if I'm right that there is such this phenomenon of bias knowing, that has certain implications for certain proposed norms of philosophical methodology that are supposed to guard against philosophical inquiry, against biases, those norms are called into question. And I also think it has certain interesting implications for discussions of radical skepticism. Anyway, that's just a little teaser. I believe that it's been bias knowing, and I think it's philosophically significant.
Well, that's fantastic. Thomas, thank you so much for joining me today on the New Books in Philosophy podcast to talk about your book. It's been really, really wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you.
And we should.
I really enjoy doing it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We should thank our listeners. So thank you, listeners, for joining us for this discussion. I've been talking with Thomas Kelly. His new book, which is just published by Oxford University Press, which I highly recommend, is titled Bias, A Philosophical Study. Thank you for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and bye for now.